Accession number 21095, reel 31.
Hello, Pick, reel 31. You were talking about self-censorship. Did you experience much in the way of censorship or sort of editorial control in The Guardian under the various sort of editors?
Certainly not censorship. Editorial control, yes, at various levels. Not in the sense of an editor saying you can only write about this, that, or the other, and nothing else, or vice versa. But clearly, you know, pieces were commissioned by various heads of department, and Richard Gott is a sort of prime example who would dream up something that he thinks you should write about, and then, you know, totally change his mind and decide that he didn't really want it after all, and that was the end of that, and there was no way you could appeal against it. It just wouldn't be used. And, you know, whoever controls the physical space on a page can exercise control, censorship at any time. But, you know, it's in the nature of the beast. You know, on any given day, you try to establish at editorial conferences early in the day what subjects are going to be covered, who is writing what, and so on and so forth. But come the afternoon, all kinds of things may be happening which you hadn't anticipated when you mapped out what the paper, what the content would be. And, you know, things almost by definition have to change. And then something you've written just gets knocked out, either before the first edition, either between the first edition and the second edition. And you know, you have to concede. There's nothing you can do about it. You can complain, but, you know, usually you just become unpopular if you complain too much. I mean, I've learned that to my cost. You know, you have to accept somebody's judgment. I certainly haven't experienced a situation where, you know, an editor suddenly decided a particular subject shouldn't be covered at all, or that a particular angle is, you know, for sort of doctrinal reasons, shouldn't be pursued, and so on. No, I mean that really, I've never experienced that. You know, usually these things are more subtle, and you know, sometimes. I remember one, I can't remember, but I've talked about that. I think I have talked about it, how when the Tories were electing a successor to Mrs. Thatcher, and the Guardian's editor had decided that there would be, you know, on three successive days, on each day, one piece in favour of one of the candidates and one against his suitability as Prime Minister or leader of the Conservative Party, and on the third, on the last day, John Major was still due to be done, and somebody had already been asked to write an article supporting his candidacy, and but it suddenly realised that there was no one had been asked to write the arguments against Major, and it ended up with myself and our then city editor asked to, by the editor, to write that piece against John Major's qualifications to become Prime Minister. And the morning, it appeared the next morning, that was the morning when he was elected to become Prime Minister, and it took him a very long time to forgive me for that piece. But I mean, that was an example of an editor actually deciding, you know, to write a piece from a specific point of view. But no, the Guardian really does not interfere, hasn't certainly in my time never interfered with the bias that any of its writers gave to stories. I mean, you were expected writing news stories to report, to do straight reporting. Obviously, that was crucial. But on the other hand, nothing is totally objective ever in journalism, and just the way you report an event, your choice of emphasis is a very subjective matter. But then, you know, I'm quite convinced from all that I know about journalism that in print journalism, people on the whole only work for the kind of papers with which they have some kind of sympathy. I mean, I never thought of myself as capable of working for, let's say, the Telegraph or even the Sunday Times or the Times at a pinch, yes, but equally there are a lot of people who could never envisage writing for The Guardian because they just feel it's a culture that is not theirs. So I think to that extent an editor will know that his staff or her staff will accept the sort of general culture of a newspaper if they work for it. And if they can't do it, then probably, you know, each side will feel very uncomfortable and the relationship won't last very long. I would say, I mean, this is not perhaps the best place to say it, that, you know, the nature of the permanency of employment in the media has changed so hugely in my time. And when I joined The Guardian, you know, it was just assumed that once I was there, my career would be with The Guardian in various capacities. I think the same applied to virtually every national newspaper. I mean, the broadsheets, tabloids were always, you know, slightly different. But I mean, nowadays there is really no permanence, and what I think is very sad is that there has been very little evolution in terms of creating career structures in the print media. In the BBC, you have a bit more structure, but even that has now tended to evaporate. But it is really, on the whole, it has become more and more contract work and less permanence attaches to it. Of course, the breakdown of the closed shop undoubtedly contributed to that, because as long as the closed shop was operated, it was very difficult to move from one paper to another. I mean, it was not as difficult as finding your way into print journalism. Because unless you were a member of the union, you couldn't get in, and so, you know, it was a chicken and egg thing, which was very difficult, which is why most journalists had to start working on small time regional local papers as a way of working their way into membership of the National Union of Journalists. But at least you know, just because of the sort of immobility of the unions, you tended to have a bit more of a not a structure, but at least people could envisage remaining on the paper and gradually rising to something. Though, of course, the limitations of print journalism are great. You can't, I mean, a paper at any one time can only have one editor, and the broadsheets on the whole tend to keep their editors in place for a very long time. So the apex is clearly not open to very many people, and to be a departmental head is not something that attracts every journalist, because to be the foreign editor, you spend your life organizing other correspondents, but you're not really writing yourself. To be features editor is the same thing. Well, people on the whole tend to enjoy doing that for 2 or 3 years at a time, but then they want out again, and the only kind of promotion that there really was in my area was the posting that you got. I mean, clearly, to be Washington correspondent is superior to being, say, Nairobi correspondent or whatever it is. And, you know, on the whole, if you've done 3 or 4 years in Moscow, you could expect to be posted to Washington just to sort of get the easier posting. But the degree of promotion that's open to people in journalism is still it's an awkward accession up the ladder, and you know, some people will be content just with either having major job definitions. Others would like to graduate to become columnists, commentators, editorial writers. But seniority is based much more on, well, it used to be based as much on longevity of service as it was on what you were actually doing. And nowadays, it's really, it is mainly what you're doing. And, of course, you can be pitched in from the outside. You don't have to start anymore as a junior reporter in order to become chief foreign correspondent or, you know, a labor correspondent or whatever you like to like it to be. People brought in from the outside, but equally, you are much freer to move to other papers, but it's an awkward profession if you are looking for a sort of proof positive of advancement. There is obviously the question of whether journalists want to move over, so to speak, into management, into administration. I think this is relatively rare, and management, newspaper management today is highly professional, and but it requires different experience, different professional, different expertise than that which is required to be a good journalist. So there's nothing that suggests that there's anything inherently easy in moving from being a reporter or columnist to being business head of a media organization, and it happens very, very little. Most papers have a position called executive editor, and that is actually a managerial position, and that is one position where journalists have tended to move into, because it covers editorial budgeting and also the management of and the choice of technology and supervising the technology which is being used on papers, but there it does help to know more precisely what a journalist's needs are. But I think perhaps I should also emphasize that on The Guardian, certainly during all my years there was a really pretty strict separation of powers between the management, the administration, and the editorial side of the paper. The only points at which those two converged really were, first of all, in The Guardian Trust and the trustees, because they did include the representative of the management, and also in the attempts that were made at various times by editors to allow some degree of familiarization between the journalists and the chairman and managing director of the whole organization, and sort of once or twice a year there would be sort of meetings where the whole editorial staff was invited, where the managing director would come and talk to the journalists a bit and would open himself to questions. But the contact is minimal. And I think that's as it should be. I think to that degree, the Guardian differs from papers that have a proprietor who takes a direct interest. The Guardian has no owners. It's a trust, and it is the trust that controls the choice of editors, and which is the guardian of the editorial independence of the paper and of the people who work for it. Where you have a proprietor, clearly the position is very, very different, and I can't speak for that. But clearly, there is interference, and there is much greater contact between the proprietor and the journalists. I would, of course, say that the editor of the Guardian always must have a close relationship with the management, but again, the trust is there to ensure that no pressures are put on the editor in terms of what of the paper's contents, pricing, promotion, those are the kind of issues that have to be discussed with editors.
You mentioned the Gulf crisis and the Gulf War earlier on, Hella, and I wonder if I could ask you more about this. Would you have been involved, you know, in reporting this right from the start, the beginning of the crisis?
Yes, I was very much involved in that. The reporting of the diplomacy surrounding it, not the on field reporting. I was certainly much involved in the run-up to the actual outbreak of fighting. I mean, when the Allied forces finally fought the campaign that got Iraq out of Kuwait. But in all the maneuverings at the Security Council, I was much involved. I was also particularly involved because an American journalist friend of mine in London had secured the transcript of the conversations that had taken place between the American ambassador in Baghdad and Saddam Hussein. I think we've gone into that before, in which, and that transcript made it very, very clear that the Americans had actually signaled to Saddam Hussein that there would be no interference if he intervened in Kuwait. I mean, it was a really very damning document. And I now know what the source of that document was. It was an Iraqi diplomat. As far as we know, it was an accurate account. The person in London who got hold of it had it translated into English from the Arabic by an Iraqi who was actually working for the Independent, the newspaper. And for some reason or other, the Independent didn't pick this up at all, and it was given to me. And I was obviously very excited when I got it, and at the Guardian, there was a great deal of interest too. But the editor didn't cotton on to just how significant the document was. And though I was given, I think, virtually a whole page to summarize it in, it was not given the kind of prominence which I think it deserved. It should obviously have been have led the paper, which it did not. And this and the piece was then picked up by the Washington Post, and then it started making sort of headlines all around the world. And I still feel frustrated that, you know, I who had this incredible scoop, even though, you know, it was all there, we hadn't made enough of it to draw attention to it.
Was it really explicit?
Look, I can't remember the wording anymore. I would have to look it up. But yes, it was it was the American ambassadress. Her name was Glaspie, and she was a woman diplomat. And she was acting under instructions from the State Department. But you know, it was a report of several meetings, because I mean they'd seen the troop build-ups and. I think she had made it clear that the United States would not intervene, and he interpreted that as virtually a green light to go ahead. But anyway, from that time on, from that time onwards, I was, as I have said, I had my friend in New York, and he and I would compare notes every day, and. I wrote a great deal about the sort of diplomatic toings and froings and the pressures that were brought on Saddam Hussein to withdraw without a fight, and meetings and I went to Geneva for meetings with Iraqis who came there, and I think I went to New York. I mean, this after dragged on for quite a long time, and. Then when the fighting broke out, then again, I mean, my job was really to sort of cover the Security Council resolutions that followed the Iraqi withdrawal and the imposition of sanctions, and you know, all this just went on and on and on and on. And I wrote a great deal about all of that. And
was it covered? Was the sort of intervention, the Allied intervention, really covered by the UN resolutions, do you think? Or is there some doubt about that, as the Iraqis claim?
Well, I think the UN intervention was covered in the sense that the UN mandated the United States and its allies to undertake the operations, and the UN certainly mandated all the arms subsequent arms inspections and so on. But you know, everything is open to interpretation, and you always have to question Security Council resolutions that were adopted without the specific endorsements of at that time of the Russians, because I mean the Russians remained in the sidelines as far as the Security Council resolutions were concerned, for some of them. But on the other hand, the Russians were very active diplomatically, both in the efforts to persuade Saddam Hussein to withdraw before military intervention took place, before the Allied military intervention took place. Primakov later became Russian Prime Minister, briefly, who is one of the Middle East experts of the Soviet foreign policy establishment, made a great many attempts to inject Russia, Moscow into the negotiations and into handling Saddam Hussein. But I think in the end, the fact that the United States, with Britain, have tried to dominate the debate in the United Nations all these years has been very counterproductive, and it's very easy to see how the patience of other members of the Security Council and indeed the key countries in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, how their patience has worn very thin indeed. And how the, you know, it was always clear that the United States, with unfortunately Britain always endorsing everything that the Americans were doing, were just using the United Nations and the United Nations institutions in order as a sort of backing and something that would give their policies a legitimacy, which I think after a point they probably didn't deserve. And the periodic bombardments that have been carried out in support of the self-appointed task of safeguarding the Kurdish minorities in Iraq are a perversion of UN Security Council resolutions, from at least to the extent that I judge it. Unfortunately, it has not been challenged enough. And equally, the whole implementation of the resolutions that allow Saddam Hussein to sell a degree of petroleum, of oil, in exchange for food and medicines has been misused by the Americans and Britain, and has certainly not achieved the aim which they have, which is of ending Saddam Hussein's reign. I think it has done more damage than good, and has certainly undermined the authority of the United Nations, because it is a prime example of a superpower with one of its allies, distorting the meaning of Security Council resolutions in order to pursue rather ill-defined policies. But there, you see, I'm expressing opinions, and as a journalist, I should just be reporting what is happening.
But I expect no clue. This is based on very careful research, you know, and the sort of means of that which you have, you know, described.
No,
so
I think it's based partly on preconceived ideas. It's based partly on what I've heard people who are intimately connected with the administration of some of these resolutions have said, and I think it's based partly on just on a judgment of failure in terms of it's perfectly obvious that Saddam Hussein is as firmly in power today as he was in 1990, and that he has today gained the sympathy and support of some of the countries that regarded him as his enemies, and I mean his neighbors in the Middle East, and has certainly also gained support in France, in Germany, almost everywhere in Europe except in Britain and in the United States. And, you know, there is this feeling that this is now a sort of personal vendetta, that it reflects a perception that perhaps it was wrong not to pursue Saddam back to Baghdad at the time of the war and win a victory over his forces, which would have forced him out of power. But at the time, there was great concern that Iraq would disintegrate, and that the dangers of a civil war in Iraq were even greater than maintaining Saddam Hussein in power, and that the impact of a disintegrating Iraq on the rest of the Middle East would have been so negative that it was better to keep him there. I think a lot of Americans, and certainly George W. Bush, probably feels, and probably his father feels, that he took the wrong decision then. And George W. now wants to remedy and avenge that mistake. But I don't think that's a policy.
Do you foresee escalation of, you know, that situation now with the recent bombing?
No, not really, because, I mean, for one thing, Saddam Hussein is perfectly well aware that he has more countries that sympathize with his position than who see him as an enemy who has to be dealt with. And I think he stands to gain much more, both in terms of his domestic backing and also in terms of the backing of the rest of the Arab world by being able to protest against the treatment that is being meted out by Britain and by the United States and by Britain and by acting against them. And what can he do? Of course, I'm very well aware that intelligence sources are suggesting that he is fast on the way to rebuilding both his nuclear capacity and his ability to wage germ warfare. I'm not for the moment suggesting that he is a person who is prepared to do anything good in this world, but I can't judge whether the potential, whether his war machine has a potential to really damage either his neighbors or that he has any long-range capabilities. But certainly, you know, I have to admit that that appeared to be intelligence reports that suggest that time has not stood still in Baghdad, and that he is once again developing arsenals that do spelled danger for his for the Middle East and for the rest of the world. So, and to that extent, I can sympathise, but I just do not believe that the means that are being used, i.e., casual bombardments, are a way to unseating Saddam Hussein or preventing him from acquiring new technologies. The more friends that he gains, the more opportunities he has. Sorry, it's the paint, my voice.